Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Hey everybody, Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Glad you could join us today for a conversation with Mike Klein. Mike is the executive chairman and CEO of iCAD, a publicly traded medical technology company. He has a background in working with a number of med tech, pharma, and healthcare companies. From Fortune 200 companies to startups. Looking forward to our conversation with Mike today.
Well, it's great to have Mike Klein joining us today. And Mike, we've known each other for a number of years and definitely have always enjoyed conversations with you. And looking forward to some insights that you have for us today. I guess, first off, can you give us just a brief overview of your career?
Sure. I think I divide my career, I look at it in two parts. The first part was with large sort of Fortune 200 companies, such as Becton Dickinson, General Electric, and Varian. And then about 20 plus years ago, I started going down the startup path and had my first startup called R2 Technology, a women's health company. That was then sold, and I moved to another women's health company called Zoft Inc. Both companies were sold. And my third company was a prostate cancer company out of North Carolina. And that's still an active company. And most recently, I joined a company called iCAD Medical, which is a publicly traded company, which in a sense is actually a combination of those first two companies, an artificial intelligence company and a women's healthcare therapy company. So this is almost like giving away your children at 13 and then bringing them back home again at 22 and running them as a public company.
Great. If you were able, knowing what you know now, if you're able to go back to that 22-year-old Mike Klein, what advice would you give him?
All right. That's a good question. Well, I often think about this because I have three boys in their 20s. So this is frequently the case. So there's a couple of things I've passed on to them, which in a sense will answer your question. And it has to do with balance. And it's what I've learned over the years, which is, and I learned it in my 20s, which is, I'd say, point one, perfection is often the enemy of the good. And that in the elusive quest to try to get that last 5%, you might take the 95% and squander an opportunity because you waited too long. The second thing would be that it's obviously a balance between people orientation and results orientation, and that both are critically important, and you can't err on the side of just being focused on results without the people, and you can't focus exclusively on the people elements without driving towards the results. And I'd say maybe one other point is having a really good tolerance for ambiguity and recognizing that you don't have all the information that you may need to have as you may move along. And the fourth thing is something I've learned along the way is what I call accurate empathy. Accurate self-assessment. Accurate empathy is actually a fifth one. But accurate self-assessment is the ability to try to see yourself as others see you in situations. And when you're driving home from a meeting, try to debrief on what did I do well? What could I have done differently? And essentially almost becoming a self-learning computer. And actually I learned a lot of these things because a lot of the thesis work I did in my graduate program was based on executive development and what are the things that made people move to the top. And I began to incorporate those things into my toolkit, if you will, in my 20s, and they really served me well.
Is there any advice that you ignore?
I would say that it's interesting. I mean, a lot of people say, you told me in the early days that you really should try to find a niche and to specialize in something so that you can kind of get your brand or your cachet. I found out, and some of this was through my early work at GE where I was rotated through many assignments, and the same thing happened at Becton Dickinson. So I became more of a generalist, and having that broad-based capability. And some of these assignments were 3 and 6 months over 2 to 3 years. So I learned the full set of general management skills early on. So I wasn't really a specialist. I was more of a generalist. And I was able to therefore adjust to a lot of different circumstances. So the advice I've given to young folks, and I think you know that I also teach at University of Santa Clara, right, is jump at opportunities that may open new doors for you. And even if they're lateral promotions or slightly diagonal, and don't necessarily let the title or even the money scare you, because if you're picking up skills, you could monetize that later on. So just try to broaden your skill set. And along the way, you may find out, as in my case, that your center of gravity became more of, let's say, sales, marketing, and commercialization. But don't start with that. Let it kind of come forward. Try to get a broad-based education and apply multiple skills that will make you a better strategic thinker, and all across the landscape of what you may do, it'll help you.
Tell us a little bit about your thoughts around mentors, the importance of mentors.
Yeah. You know, I think that's critical. I have to say that, I don't know, maybe it's a little embarrassing to me, but I don't actually think I had one particular really singular mentor, but I had a lot of, you might call them, supporters and advocates. There wasn't that one person, however. So in my mind, I became aware of the importance of mentoring. So I said, you know what, I'm going to kind of create my own virtual mentor. Now, some of my colleagues actually have that singular mentor. And for whatever reason, that just never really happened for me. And it might have been because I was moving around through a lot of these opportunities. So I had to kind of create this sort of virtual mentor, almost like a Yoda-like figure. And that had a lot of different, you know, competencies and capabilities. So I actually would write down what are the skills and competencies that it would take to run a company. And I literally tried to visualize what all those things would look like. And I actually even started trying to act that way, even though I had to not really act completely that way because I wasn't in the job. But I remember being a director or a VP thinking to myself, how would a general manager or CEO or president of a division or a company operate or act in these situations? So that became kind of my virtual mentor. I sure wish I had one, but I do think, if you don't have a mentor, come up with the concept of creating one, because it'll really guide you along your way.
That's good. So tell me about if you were to pick a few books that you've read over the years that you think are must-reads for a new leader, what would those books be?
Well, sure. Well, in the early days, it was always In Search of Excellence, and then Collins and Porras, Good to Great, and then the sequels of those books, or The One-Minute Manager, or there's a couple that had some names about no blank kinds of people involved, which really focused on, you know, making sure you had the right people on the bus. More recently, I've been really reading a lot of books about lean management, the disciplined entrepreneur, scrum management, the ability to have, let's say, short bursts, thinking of projects in short 90-day bursts. And this actually was written by someone who was in the Air Force that literally talked about these deployments that were like 6 weeks or 12 weeks. And in rapid moving business environments today, you could hardly think of a 3 to 5 year plan. Everything's going to change. Technology is going to obsolesce itself. So I also read everything. I probably read 2 to 3 different books at a time, not per week, but I have 2 or 3 different books going on at the same time, whether it's Sapiens or Red Notice or nonfiction books or lots of biographies. Oh, lots of biographies. Probably biographies of every single president, from Adams to Lincoln to Teddy Roosevelt, who is my favorite, to the George Bush one. I actually find that those particular biographies and how these people broke through, even Michelle Obama's recent book, The Wives of People Who made it Big, because she made it big in her own right. So getting a lot of angles and getting a lot of information from a lot of different perspectives. So, I mean, I could go on and on because there's a lot of books I recommend on behavioral economics for my students, et cetera. But be well-read. And here's one little tip. Before you invest your time in reading, you know, a 400-page book, listen to the YouTube video where the author may be presenting at a book reading. And you'll get about 30-40% of the essence from that. And then you can go out and buy the book and read more.
Got it. How do you, if you were to describe how you lead today versus how you led when you first became an executive, how would you describe the difference?
Well, I think when I led, I probably had two styles. One was either, and I often say it kind of grew up because I grew up in the era when the Flintstones and the Jetsons were the big cartoons. And if you remember the bosses, there was like Spacely from Spacely Sprockets and Mr. Slate. So the model I had growing up was that there was this hard-nosed boss that was very demanding. And so that was one thing I had running in the back of my head. But then I started learning very quickly about a more democratic, participative style. But then as I started reading some books about situational leadership and even situational sales, I recognized that you needed to have a whole golf bag full of different styles based on the maturity of the employees in terms of time and job, the situation and the circumstances, and whether you needed to delegate, in some cases even abdicate. In certain cases, for new employees, you had to be more of a, I want to say, therapeutically autocratic because folks just didn't know. And you had to be almost like directing people to keep them out of danger almost. But that style really gave way to a far more democratic and participative style. And what I call today a style that I best describe as the guide by the side instead of the sage on the stage. And I learned that particular phrase, I borrowed that phrase from some books I've read about millennial leadership. And millennials are also individuals that want to know why they're doing something. So my dad used to tell me that when he was young, he was simply told what to do. And I said, that's funny, Dad. In my generation, I at least got the opportunity to discuss how to do it. But now all these young folks are passion driven. They have lots of choices. They can find jobs, at least out here in the Silicon Valley, within a couple of days. So you need to answer the question of why, because they're passion and purpose driven. So any new leader today, I'd say, find the why, get people tied into the purpose, the mission, the objective, give them a seat at the table, be the guide on the side, and you'll be a much more effective leader.
If you were a new leader hiring their first team, what advice would you give as you're putting together your first team?
Yeah, I would try to create a democracy of equals. I would try to level set the organization as much as possible, even if it's not structurally, but you create meetings, dynamics, projects where you get a good look at everybody. And so, for example, in the last two companies I was in, I inherited organizations that had 3 to 4 people all reporting to the top. And I basically, without taking away titles, I level set the organization with projects and programs that gave me access to 12, 13 people. And some of these people felt that they were buried previously and didn't have access. And I got to see the people that rose to the occasion. And then after I saw what was really working in the organization, I then followed the rule of form follows function. So what was working, I then turned into a newly created organization that was either matrixed or a lot flatter. They may have had 5, 6. I've had 12 people reporting to me. But whatever was functionally correct, and I could see that operating, I then structured the organization accordingly.
Good. What qualities do you look for in a leader?
Well, I really believe that people have to be all in and believe and be able to instill that sense of purpose and passion. So the first thing is they've got to be a true believer. They've got to totally, completely believe in the product and in the people and in the journey and the destination. That's number one. Without that, you can have all the business school training in the world, but you're just not going to get, you're not going to get people to follow. As they say, I remember hearing the quote, the essence of good leadership is followship. Will people follow you? Leaders also create meaningful and clear goals and objectives, but they're aspirational goals. They're not just ones that are 3 months or 6 months out. It's something they could strive for. It's sort of a North Star. And it's not just what we are today, but what we could be. You know, I remember reading a mission or vision statement from Google years ago that said, organizing everything in the world. Now, that's pretty aspirational, but, you know, maybe too aspirational. But having that kind of a North Star, this compelling vision, and then making sure that every single person and every single department feels that in any, to the greatest extent possible, that every department and every person in some way is contributing to that vision. So in my current situation, it's artificial intelligence and using artificial intelligence tools to read very complex medical images. Everybody in the company has to be involved in understanding what the diseases that we're dealing with, in this case is breast cancer. You go out, you participate in the events, the walk for the cure, the race for the cure, meet your customers, be all in, invite your customers in to give presentations on how you've impacted them, changed their lives. We name conference rooms after them. So we're continually mindful of why we're doing what we're doing and how it's important. And align everybody's goals so they feel that they're a part of this bigger and broader agenda. And I always say, when you're 80 years old, sitting back with hopefully a couple of grandchildren around you, what do you want to be? What stories do you want to be able to tell about your career? What do you want to be able to say you did and accomplished? And I always think about that, and I always ask people to think about that, because that encourages us to be our best and do the best we can to contribute something more to society than we're extracting. We all have to be net contributors in some way. And if we all do that, the world evolves and has evolved to being a better place.
Right. Being in the business that I'm in, I always ask the question, what are your favorite interview questions?
Well, you know, I always like the questions about what kind of environment would you be successful in? Or what kind of, I actually like the question, if someone was going to, if I was to ask you about 3 to 5 adjectives to describe yourself, what would it be? Because that gives me an opportunity to really put out, you know, what I really think is my brand and what I contribute. I really like when people ask me about achievements and what I did. And I also really like when they ask me about where I failed, because I'm a big believer that you learn more from failure than success is oftentimes. It's harder to see what's working than it is to see what didn't work. And sometimes you learn more from bad bosses than good bosses, because when they're doing the magic that works, it's not always as observable. The question about that I always found challenging is, where do you want to be in the next 5 years, right? And that's always a tough one, because careers move with such velocity today. So the way I've answered that is to more describe the kind of impact I want to have, the kind of scope of abilities I want to have. Titles change. There's all kinds of interesting permutations of that. So I kind of describe more the environment and the situation and what I'm aspiring to. But I always enjoy when executive search professionals and hiring managers ask me the right questions, not yes, no questions, but open-ended questions that allow me to tell my story.
Right. So is there anything in the past 5 years, a new habit, behavior, belief that you've had that's improved your life?
That's really interesting. I would say, well, first of all, on a personal note, I can tell you that having a balanced life in terms of getting up in the morning and working out and exercising gives me the ability to sharpen the saw, to use one of the old expressions that was in Stephen Covey's books. So you really do need to have a little bit of a balanced life, and also a balanced not only physical and mental, but spiritual life. That's become really important. And whatever your religion is or belief, I'm a real believer in meditation and finding those ways to kind of get yourself into a contemplative posture. That is absolutely key. I could not be doing what I'm doing at the age I'm doing. And I think, you know, going back into running a high-performance company that really is a publicly traded startup company, if I didn't have those tools. And those tools have enabled me to be a little more relaxed about seeing the big picture in things, sort of suspending judgment and waiting till I have enough information, but not waiting too long. And really getting to understand people on a personal level, not just because a book told me I should, but because I'm really interested in what they're about. So I think that in this phase of my career, I think authenticity is important, but you can't fake authenticity. You have to have a genuine interest in people. So I really try to get to know their spouses, their kids, what's going on. Even if there's an illness in the family or death, I really try to get to know that stuff because that's important for me personally. Because at the end of the day, we're all human beings trying to do our best. And I think this kind of later phase in life set of leadership skills has very much incorporated trying to have a more of a holistic relationship with the people I work with and at every level. Sometimes that person that's sitting at the front desk, that receptionist that nobody notices, who is the gatekeeper and the first face that someone sees when they come into the building, they've got a whole story. They've got a whole struggle they've gone through. They can help the company. And I find it fascinating to get to know everybody.
It's great. Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate your time and your insights. And as always, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.